Hello and welcome to the Majlis, the weekly podcast by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, focusing on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. So last week, government of Uzbekistan held a big forum on human rights in Samarkand. There were a number of people in the room, but the bigger number of people who should have been or could have been there were not or could not. Today we will talk about what all this conference was about. Also, around those days, a press statement came out signed by a number of human rights organizations praising the authorities about the progress so far and also expressing concern, among others, on the renewed surveillance of human rights activists in Uzbekistan. Which brings me to this fundamental question. What has really changed or has not changed in the situation of human rights under the new administration in Uzbekistan and why? To discuss all these, I'm joined by Brigitte Dufour, president of International Partnership for Human Rights, who has just came back from Uzbekistan. Steve Siberdlou, Human Rights Watch's Central Asia researcher, who is currently in Uzbekistan. Alisher Ilhamov, research associate at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London. Bruce Panier, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owozi in Prague. Welcome on board, colleagues.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Very nice to have you. Okay, so Steve, you are on the ground. Let's start with you. The conference last week, what was that all about?
Good question. Well, it was called the Asian Forum for Human Rights. And already I think that title displays some of the ambivalence around what this was. Are human rights Asian? Of course not. So a lot of us were asking that question. But, you know, in the most charitable interpretation of what occurred, this was a baby step, even if we want to call it that, of this government to come out and essentially put on a big gathering and host a discussion ostensibly about human rights. And to, I guess, again, in the most charitable interpretation, to widen the space for discussion about human rights in a country which has had such a repressive and terrible human rights record in the past. But in reality, it was mostly a talk shop where diplomats and government officials largely, vastly outnumbered actual human rights defenders. But there were activists from the other four Central Asian countries that were doing great work and were speaking up. And there were very few, almost none, local human rights defenders in Uzbekistan that were at the conference. But I think, you know, one could look at some of the commitments that the government took at the end of the conference. They signed a declaration called the Samarkand Declaration, which, again, in theory and on paper, purports to commit Uzbekistan and the region to upholding human rights values. And there was, you know, there were a lot of aspirations stated about the ratification of the Convention on Persons with Disabilities, the rights of the child, and a lot of commitments that, if they were implemented, could really bring Uzbekistan forward. And so I think I speak for some other colleagues in the human rights community when I say that we tried to use the forum as a way to leverage progress to push this government to keep going forward.
Thanks, Steve. We will definitely like to focus on the implementation of the promises that were made in the past. So still sticking with the conference, Brigitte, any sign of progress, a step forward in this gathering? I guess my question is, you went to Uzbekistan all the way from Europe to attend this conference. So what was your takeaway, joy or disappointment about what you saw there?
Well, first of all, I tend to agree with everything that Steve just said, and he was very charitable, as he said, regarding this, to at least show that maybe that there was something positive in this whole exercise. But of course, for me, that was not I cannot say that this was a useful use of my time coming from Europe to attend such a conference, because it was a big show. It was mostly a symbolic effort, like something to show that Uzbekistan could hold such international conferences about human rights. But at the same time, it was holding this under strict control and with very little representation from civil society in Uzbekistan. So that was really deplorable to me and to colleagues from many countries who were present in Samarkand, while it has been very difficult for our colleagues in Uzbekistan to get any information about this. They were hearing about it from us. So that was quite peculiar.
And also, I watched the short segment of your speech during that conference, and you were looking into the eyes of authorities probably present in the room and saying that there are a number of people missing from the, I believe you were pointing at the local human rights activists there.
Yes.
Talk us a little bit about that moment.
Well, this meeting from the beginning, there was a kind of effort that they were undertaking all the time to speak about civil society, the role of civil society, how important civil society is. There was a lot about the sustainable development goals, which is now something that is used much more when governments try to speak about human rights and about the human rights conventions themselves. And also these sustainable development goals are only possible if you want to achieve them, if you involve civil society. So I got a little annoyed at the last session where I felt this is incredible because they speak about that all the time, but they don't give the floor to any civil society representative on the panels. I mean, there was a possibility for NGOs to speak in working groups that were like when everybody was separated into three working groups. But in all the panel discussions, it was government officials, international organizations, governmental ones, I mean, and no civil society representatives. So at the last session, I really felt, well, I think they should hear what we all thought, all of us were talking about and thinking we have to voice that officially, that we feel like those who should have been there were absent. And that was the main failure of this whole conference. Mm.
You know, as a moderator, I always try to hide my own opinion about what's being discussed in the show. But on this aspect, you know, for me, these big events, as you were saying, Bridget and Steve, is not really proof of anything significant. We see similar grandiose events every week in Turkmenistan almost, so we have to really analyze as we are doing on the substance. So coming back to Samarkand, you know, it's good that Steve and some other human rights activists were there present, but did you have the chance to talk to the authorities on one-on-one? Why so many other people, especially Steve, you referred to local activists, why they were not allowed? How would the authorities would they explain that?
Well, yeah, you know, I want to dive just a little bit deeper and say that, because you mentioned Turkmenistan, that at the conference, and we have to give some credit to the press. You know, you had Kun Uz, you had other agencies that were around, and at least I felt free. And I know that some of this was printed because some of my colleagues were also with me, Andrew Strohline. We were talking about censorship on Uzbek national TV, on Uzbekistan 24, from morning until night. So, I mean, I think from the very practical, pragmatic perspective, as I said in the beginning, we were trying to leverage what little space they were offering to push the envelope.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Steve, again, pointing at my question, the bottom line question that I asked about this conference, that the Bridget also expressed frustration about local activists who were not present, who were absent from this specific conference that we are talking about. How authorities would explain that, why local activists were not allowed to come in?
Right. The authorities, well, there are different authorities here, but the National Center for Human Rights response was, we did invite some activists, others we didn't invite, and they had their negotiations with the UN, and that is clearly shameful, and we tried to make that clear. And I think there was another incident where some activists had picketed in Tashkent and demonstrated asking to come to this conference. Some of them even came to Samarkand and got detained. And that just hasn't been reported yet. And so, I you know, we're doing our best to just express how shameful and scandalous that is.
Okay, let me bring on Alisher Yu here. So it looks like the Uzbek authorities, you know, I'm just trying to point out the ambiguity here. So Uzbek authorities are trying to do something, but really not open to do it properly. What is your take on what we have been talking about so far around this conference?
Yes, indeed. What Steve and Bridget actually were talking about is reflecting overall situation in the country, where we see indeed some kind of opening, some kind of improvement, especially in the field of civil and political rights. At the same time, we can make an assessment of the situation only through some kind of comparative perspective. Compared to the past, the Karimov past, definitely some improvement. But if you compare with the neighboring Kazakhstan, which is itself actually authoritarian and repressive regime, but even the Uzbekistan can be put on the same plane actually in terms of available freedoms, the space for freedom. For instance, in Kazakhstan, the number of international organizations have accreditation, operating without problems, many NGOs operating without problems. and we can continue this list of indicators. So Uzbekistan still not yet even reached what the level Kazakhstan has achieved in both in terms of economic development, but most important in terms of available civic freedoms. And in the same time, you know, we see the emerging a new pattern of human rights violations in the country. If the situation with the civil and political rights a little bit slightly improving, but in terms of social economic rights, the situation becoming to some extent, you know, worse in uncanny of time. Mm-hmm. And it has very much to do with corruption and corrupt practices, which now we see the rising up because of collusion between the public office and the private sector and the businesses, with so-called oligarchs.
That's an interesting point. Alisher, did you try to go to this conference?
No, first of all, nobody invited me, but those who could be regarded as left the country in the past on political reasons, they don't have yet enough confidence to return back without kind of jeopardizing the safety and security. So in my case, I am Uzbek citizen. I have not renounced Uzbek citizenship, but even I don't know whether I've been deprived Uzbek citizenship or not. I am citizen by decision of the government or not, because we see the most recently a number of political refugees just a few months ago found out that they have been kind of deprived of citizenship by the government quite recently, 2017.
Yeah,
Safar Bigjan and Mehdi Niyazova, without any kind of consultation and notification from the government, they were kind of deprived of Uzbek citizenship.
So, Bruce, so you were not the only person missing from the room. So it looks like, you know, you didn't miss much. But aside from the conference, Bruce, a couple of days ago, we have also seen a press statement released by a coalition of NGOs, perhaps deliberately published last week. It was talking about a renewed surveillance of human rights activists. And Tashkent's actions apparently doesn't match what the concept of this conference was.
That's not so surprising. You know, I don't want to say that the government hasn't really changed much. They have. I mean, there's been some significant changes in the country. There's no doubt about it. And this isn't even a question of old habits die hard, I think. You know, this is just one of those things where, you know, the new government, Mirziyoyev's government, is not entirely sure of how their support within the country, of their support internationally. And hence, we have events like this where they're trying to charm everyone into believing that this is a whole new system that's being created here. But in fact, you know, there's still probably cause for them to worry. There are people who would like the government to speed up reforms much more quickly than they're going to be happening anytime in the foreseeable future. And, you know, this has traditionally been a government that's erred on the side of paranoia, if anything. So I can't say I'm surprised that they renewed surveillance of people. You know, and let's face it, our Uzbek service has been reporting, you know, consistently that while the government portrays one, whatever, the cotton campaign, you know, we're treating the Muslims of our country differently than they were treated under Karima. But at the same time, our Azad Lik keeps reporting that they still are doing some of the old practices. Yeah. You know, they still do monitor suspect Muslims, especially in the Fergana Valley. And now they're surveilling people who they believe are suspect activists. Mm-hmm. And we know that the cotton campaign, they didn't eradicate, you know, all forced labor in the field. So it's, you know, I suppose there's something to be said about the government. I believe anyway that the government just hasn't got to that level. I'm not letting them off the hook for this by any means at all. You know, and Ali Sheer said that they're not, Uzbekistan isn't even up to the level of neighboring Kazakhstan, but I would go so far as to say Uzbekistan isn't even up to the level of Uzbekistan was prior to May 2005. I mean, they used to be able to hold some of these conferences, not specifically on rights, but there was a much more open dialogue going at international conferences in Uzbekistan in the late 1990s and early part of the decade after the turn of the century.
Okay, so let's dive deeper into this. Earlier I was talking about relevant people missing from the conference room. In Samarkand, we are also missing one very relevant person from this show, and she is Helena Fraser, UN Resident Coordinator in Uzbekistan. She tried to join us, but couldn't make in the last minute because of some traveling schedule conflict. We will definitely have her join us in our future discussions. She follows Majlis on Twitter, which we really appreciate. So So Ms. Fraser is missing today, but we have so many distinguished guests in this show. Some of them is currently in Uzbekistan. Some has just returned from there. And some weren't or aren't welcomed by Tashkent. They are Brigitte Dufour, President of International Partnership for Human Rights, Steve Sverdlou, Human Rights Watch Central Asia Researcher in Tashkent, Uzbekistan, Alisher Ilhamov, Research Associate at the School of Oriental and African Studies, and Bruce Panier, Editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty Central Asia Blog, Kishlak Owozi. I am Mohamed Tahir, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Media Manager in Washington, D.C., and we are discussing today human rights situation in Uzbekistan under Mirziyoyev. So it's not our primary topic today, but as a journalist, it's very near and dear to me, the issue of press freedom, which I believe is the fundamental element in advancing any genuine human rights agenda. Aside from some concession for local media, authorities in Uzbekistan are also not yet open to foreign press. Also, even the small changes we have seen in local press appears to be hectic. We all know the content of the interview by Channel 24 journalist in Uzbekistan. So her comments were very striking as to the inner workings of local news organization, the censorship or the type of censorship is in place there. So talking about changes, it's been 2 years since Mirziyoyev is in power. He is running the country practically with no challenger. So looking into this from the bigger picture, what's his report card looks like in terms of situation of human rights in Uzbekistan beyond this conference, Steve?
Well, I think you have to take things issue by issue. There's clearly been some significant positive steps, but a really long way to go. And one of the issues that we've been focusing on here has been political prisoners. There have been about 35 or 40 or so released high-profile political prisoners in the last 2 years. And one thing that we're doing now is we're meeting with these folks all across the country. And we're seeing that these people that have been released, you know, with great fanfare, and, you know, these were moments of great hope and optimism for me personally, working on this for so many years and meeting, and these reunions with people have been hopeful. But then when you just scratch the surface, you see that essentially all these people are still treated like criminals or felons or ex-cons. They've received no status, no rehabilitation. And so we've been raising that with the government, that they need to provide legal avenues for these activists and former political prisoners to clear their names. And, you know, in some small way, that's an exercise in trying to open up the history books and start looking at Uzbekistan's true realities. And that's a very sensitive topic. But I'm at least finding that on that issue of criminal justice, we've sunk our teeth pretty deep into it. And there are some areas where we see some movement by the government. There have been some further releases that have been steady over the past few months, and there's some capacity to talk with Human Rights Watch about our recommendations. How far it will go and whether or not they'll really allow people to rehabilitate is a big question, but that's one issue. Another is, as you said, press freedom. I think the revelation from that reporter who worked for Uzbekistan 24 was an earthquake. It was really important, and I see a really dynamic field among the local media. But the internet censorship and the internet blockage and just the low speed of the internet, we see YouTube essentially blocked here right now, Facebook not working. It's a catastrophe. And I think there's a lot of a groundswell of discontent among the press and just ordinary people on the street that I hear everywhere. And that's something I think the government feels some pressure to have to address. We can talk about cotton. There's a lot going on there. Some significant progress forward, but still systemic quota system, systemic abuses, hundreds of thousands of people involved in forced labor. And there's a whole host of other issues to address.
Okay, let's also take the Uzbek view on this. Alisher, from your point of view, so what are the highlights on what changed so far under Mirziyoyev and what did not change during the past 2 years?
The main changes taking place mostly in the economy. In my understanding, this is, kind of reflecting how the government see their strategy kind of and the strategic priorities. And they're probably believing that you need to kind of to first of all to fix the problem with the economy, which was on the current time actually under stagnation. For instance, according to some estimations, Uzbekistan has the lowest rate in terms of attracting foreign direct investments among all post-Soviet states in terms of on per capita, foreign direct investments per capita, even lower than Tajikistan. and so they probably believe that we need to for instance, liberalize economy, to open door for the businesses, for the market economy, for investors, but probably not quite adequately understand that the success in the economic sphere could not be achieved without reforming political sphere, especially the establishing anti-corruption mechanisms. And also without respecting the rights of the people. And what we see for the moment, for instance, a number of ambitious construction projects being pushed by the government, the local government, central government, without any respect to the housing rights and of those people living in those areas, which are being now just given to the businesses, to the construction companies, without proper consultation, consent from the people, and without providing compensation, which raises the question whether the Uzbek government respect enough the property rights. If it doesn't respect the rights of the property rights of the ordinary people, then why they would then respect the property rights of the businesses and the foreign investors? So it's all these things are so much interconnected. Economic reforms, reform on the political sphere, and the human rights is something we should probably highlight, this connection between these two different aspects.
Okay. Bruce, first, your thoughts on things that are changing or not changing. Second, what does this tell you about thinking of the authorities in terms of human rights?
Well, I mean, it's slow, that's for sure. As far as rights are concerned, you know, I'm still having a problem with some of the changes in the media, more because, you know, the biggest example that someone will show of like greater freedom of media that they have in Uzbekistan is that people are able to report more on corruption. But, you know, we've even made the point on this show in the past that you can't go up too high in the levels of government and the hierarchy of government before all of a sudden you hit the wall and you understand that top officials are still off limits for this kind of reporting. Mm-hmm. Now, we know that Mirziyoyev has launched an anti-corruption campaign. I think every incoming president, by whatever means they came in, death of their predecessor or ouster of their predecessor or whatever, has always declared an anti-corruption campaign. So, you know, the media is actually kind of serving a function for Mirziyoyev at the moment by pointing this out. Now we know that they're, you know, I mentioned some people are off limits, and I would just point to the example of this deputy prime minister Mirziyoyev. Not long ago, we all saw the pictures of the people standing in the canal and holding rocks, and he had forced them to do that because he was unsatisfied with the way they were harvesting and tending the land, you know, and so he was sacked and it was applauded. Oh, here's a guy that was caught red-handed. And I, you know, I want to emphasize that when they're caught red-handed, then they have to do something about it. But he was thrown out as deputy prime minister. And I don't think it was even 10 days before he had another position as a district chief in Jizak maybe Samarkand. But so, you know, he wasn't cast out in disgrace and jailed or something.
Yeah, it was Jizak.
Jizak, okay. So, you know, I mean, this shows that there are limits to what the government is willing to do, you know, in their anti-corruption campaign or with freedom of the media. You can argue this is the early stages, but then again, it's been almost 2 years since the election. You know, so, I mean, how long do you need for some of these kind of reforms? Now, obviously, I'm happy that Yelena Orlyeva and other people are not being thrown in jail when they go out and talk to people in the cotton fields or when they hold small protests in some of these places. That's all to the good. You know, they don't receive, obviously, a lot of coverage in the media for this, you know, but the government seems to expect, you know, big applause from the international community for allowing it to go. And certainly I'm happy about it, like I said, but it doesn't represent a major change. It represents a minor change. Steve used the term baby steps at the start of this. And I guess that's kind of where we are. So I think they could go a little bit faster with some of this stuff. You know, one comment on the political prisoners, and I know Steve had made this comment earlier on previous programs, that most of these people that were let out of jail were not amnestied or pardoned. I mean, they simply served their terms, and many of them are old, you know, 60, 70, you know, so this was not an act of mercy or something, you know, to let them out. It was just the fact that their term was up. I mean, this is the way it should have worked. They should never have been put there to begin with. Mm-hmm. But in the meantime, and they served the time.
Yeah.
It's slow.
Yeah, on this, Bruce, let me bring Bridget, you here. So the number of people that Bruce was mentioning, the ones who were released, but hundreds, maybe thousands of people still remain in jail. Any idea about the thinking behind the authorities' decision? Why they let go some people and why some of them remain in jail. So what was the selection criteria? What was the motivation behind this?
I think in our international advocacy, we always, build lists, for example, in the human rights dialogues between the EU and Uzbekistan. So they have these lists of human rights defenders, political prisoners, and they try to at least show that they were releasing people on that list. That was like to please us, to please the international community. But there are so many people that don't all fit into these lists. It's just impossible, and it's a huge work. But we continue always making sure that all the others will also find justice and will be freed. But as our colleague said before, it's something to be free. And this is really important, and we really are grateful that our colleagues who were now who we can meet now in Tashkent and all are free. But at the same time, it's incredible like how their life is impossible still because they have not been rehabilitated. And it's the same with so many people, and also with Bobo Murad Abdullayev, whom you probably know. And we met him, and after we met him here, he too was under surveillance. He was, you know, in a restaurant, and someone came to him to shake hands, and he shook his hand, and it was one of the former torturers, somebody who had been beating him up. It's so cruel that this. I think that the whole problem of that country is that for some reason it seems like the authorities, they fear civil society. They don't understand the role of civil society. Like probably, like Steve will agree with me. Like when we go, we are received like officials, and I keep saying, you know, I'm a human rights activist. I'm not representing any government. Any, you don't need to receive me in like with a limousine, or you don't need to put me in an official hotel. And if I choose to go to a little bed and breakfast, it's my choice. But no, that doesn't work like that for them. It's like they have to control us, and I fear that if they have to control us this way, it's because there is a lack of trust in civil society in general. All the meetings I had in Tashkent, because that it was my second time in a month that I was in Uzbekistan, and during the visit before, that is when we were able to see with our own eyes how Aksan Turgunov was under surveillance. It was shocking to see that. And also we had meetings with the Minister of Justice, and they kept saying the law on NGO, like everything will be much better now, much easier. And when I asked about the details of this, it was not very encouraging, because you still feel like, for example, okay, you don't need a permission to organize a meeting, but you need to tell them in advance, to inform them. You need to tell them which hotel, at what time, who will take part. And if there are internationals, they have to inform them in advance. And I said, well, you know, this is control. And they said, you know, oh, this is not control. This is because we want to know, we want to be able to attend and to listen and to learn about the things. It was total like a pretext for control. But you really feel like it's so burdensome to be able to operate legally in as an NGO in that country. And I don't think it's going to change quickly. And also, there is always the issue of Andijan, who's the elephant in the room that nobody raises. It's like it never happened. And it's when you raise that, it's like a big insult. But that will have to be addressed, because if they continue and they don't address impunity, they cannot create a country that is progressive based on the rule of law and all that. So all the impunity of past abuses has to be addressed. Finally, a colleague mentioned, a guest mentioned the question of evictions, and we were in Samarkand in this big congress hall, very like palais, very beautiful and impressive. And a few hundred meters from there are populations who risk being evicted. There is a lot of things happening in Samarkand right now that are troublesome. This is a historical city, a heritage of UNESCO. Many areas are protected. And you see that right now, the investments to welcome more tourists and all that, and to change the city to make it appealing to tourists, is just disfiguring it. It's just making it a terrible place to live for the population. And I got some information about that, and I asked the people, would you like to meet? And they were afraid to meet. And I didn't want to meet if they were going to be in trouble for meeting. And I think this is you know, we hope the reforms to come true. We really hope it, because that's what the people want and what they need. There needs to be humanization of this country.
Thank you, Brigitte. So I think we also need to conclude the discussion very soon. Just two final points. So earlier, Alisher mentioned, like, you know, he is not sure of what happens if he tries to go back or he ends up in Tashkent. And on that question, you know, the travel restriction is obviously a fundamental part of any discussion if that involves human rights, Steve Severlo. So what will happen if Alisher goes to Tashkent? Or what will happen, let's say, if Mohamed Saleh comes back to Tashkent? What will happen?
Well, there was a request that Mohamed Saleh, the renowned opposition figure, made several months ago when I was here at the trial of Bobo Murad Abdullayev. He asked to testify, and he also made a public appeal to come back. And, you know, there was no official response, but I think the silence was answer enough that we don't want you back. We saw other, as Alisher mentioned, we saw other human rights activists and dissidents coming from Sweden and other countries, and they were simply turned back. At the airport, some of them were informed that they no longer had citizenship, and it was a rude awakening. We did see, if you remember, if you think back to right when this was all starting, there was a writer, an Uzbek author named Nurullah Atakhanov, who just went. I mean, he went immediately after Mirziyoyev went to New York, and he made this appeal to Uzbeks in America to come back and help build the country. And he just took him at his word, flew to Tashkent, and the second he got there, he was put in handcuffs and charged with extremism for a book that he had wrote that criticized Karima. But again, the interesting thing was in the way the authorities dealt with it. They released him within 48 hours, I think, because there was this social media outcry. Mm-hmm. And so I agree with everything that Brigitte was just saying about, you know, how troubling it is to see all these repressive practices being used. And you know, I experienced surveillance just yesterday when we were getting together, a group of activists and former political prisoners felt like the old Uzbekistan all over again. We, you know, we saw the guys in leather jackets taking our pictures and intimidating us. But at the same time, what I think is the sort of the interesting variable that wasn't there before is this, on social media in particular, this push or this critical mass of people that aren't willing to take it anymore. That in certain situations, as we saw with the farmers in the water, are saying enough already. Along with everything that Brigitte was just saying, that there is also, I continue to feel some energy, some dynamism, you know, raised expectations, and I think that's why the government is trying to slow the process down. Mm. So it's just, I think it's really important for us to push really hard and to find allies within the government that are willing to hear our message on human rights. I mean, we did praise a few officials this last week who has listened to human rights activists during a ILO-hosted cotton meeting. And, you know, when we saw good behavior, when we saw officials actually listening to the complaints of human rights activists, we told them so. And when we saw the government not inviting activists to the Asian Forum, we told them so. So I think we just really want to keep the pressure on, and I think the government has to invite Alisher back. And we raised issues on par with that as well, that they need to create a mechanism for Uzbeks abroad, but in particular, Uzbeks that have taken up the cause of democracy and human rights and create, you know, restore citizenship and allow them to safely come back to the country.
Okay, thank you, Steve. I remember since we started talking about Uzbekistan and their new leadership, your short answer to almost every critical question has been so far is that you are cautiously optimistic. I see you are still cautiously optimistic. So point was raised about Alisher. So let's end this discussion with Alisher. Alisher, so are you planning to go back? Are you prepared to test the authorities on their message?
Before the situation would be kind of more clear in terms of what we can expect from the government, what kind of how they would receive me, and whether I'll be able to enter the country. Because if they deprive me the citizenship, then I will be able to enter only with entry visa. You know, as for instance, recently Talib Yakubov was able to return only by entry visa, not as Uzbek citizen. Mm. So that means exactly most recently, you know, a month or 2 months ago, the government adopted a resolution, a decree regarding the kind of the Uzbeks living abroad in exile or in emigration. If you look read attentively this document, this you will understand it's mostly addressed to those compatriots, those Uzbeks living abroad, not political refugees, not those who left the country on political reasons. This is addressed to the, mostly to the immigrants who have professionals, who have a business, who have some money. And they're expecting from them money. They're expecting them to return in order to invest into the Uzbek economy. Mm-hmm. So it's not addressed to those who are critical of the regime. And so the, even this is one point in that decree, that those living in abroad would be provided with entry visa. Nothing to say about those who still have kept their citizenship, didn't renounce, and they wanted to return as Uzbek citizens. They already kind of closed the doors to those refugees and immigrants who don't want to renounce their Uzbek citizenship.
Okay.
They're welcoming them as foreigners.
Okay, let's see how it goes. Alisher Ilhamov, Research Associate at the School of Oriental and African Studies. Thank you very much for your time in touch today. And also big thanks goes to Brigid Dufour, President of International Partnership for Human Rights, Steve Severlu, Human Rights Central Asia Researcher, and Bruce Panier, Editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia Blog, Kishlag Owazi. Thank you, colleagues, for your time today.
Thanks,
Mohammed.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. And this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia podcast. Until next week, bye-bye.